everyone. I'm Major General Retired Clay Hupmacher. Thanks for joining us today for Soft Spoken with Quiet Professionals. Today we have Matt Waters with us, Sergeant Retired Extraordinaire Matt Waters, who is with us, and we're going to talk about an operation that Matt and I were on, codenamed Operation Reindeer, which took place June 11th, 2003, out of Western Iraq near a town called Rawa. And Matt and I were both on it. We both have unique perspectives. But before we get started, I was going to read Matt's bio and welcome him. We have stayed in contact and become friends ever since this operation. And in fact, every time I go to Washington, he sponges a free dinner off me when I go by Tacoma. So I got Sergeant Retired, I want to emphasize on Extraordinaire, Matt Waters. He enlisted in the Army in 1997 on an Airborne Ranger contract. By March of 99, a couple years later, he had already completed Airborne School, the Ranger Indoctrination Program, and Ranger School, which he hit Ranger School at about the one-year mark in 2nd Ranger Battalion at Fort Lewis. Matt first deployed to Afghanistan with B Company, 2nd Ranger Battalion, 75th Ranger Regiment, in March of 2002, and then again to Iraq, basically a year later in March of 2003. During Operation Reindeer, Matt was severely injured and was subsequently retired from the Army, medically retired from the Army in 2004. And at that time, he was immediately hired by the Tacoma Police Department, where he still works today, so 16 years later. In his 16 years with the department, Matt was first assigned to the Patrol Division, then the Disorder Response Team, followed by service as a school resource officer. And my wife's a teacher, and she has always had a warm fuzzy having a school resource officer in the halls there. And then he's currently assigned as a bomb technician with the Tacoma Police Department Bomb Squad. They live in Tacoma, Washington, with his wife, Lindsay, and they have two children, Owen and Zoe. Owen is following in his dad's footsteps and is an infantryman in the 82nd Airborne at Fort Bragg. And he just completed his first deployment to Afghanistan last year.
Yep.
Okay, so Matt, welcome.
Thanks. Thanks for having me. It's an honor to be here.
Well, listen, so what I thought we'd do is, you know, again, like I said earlier, Matt and I have, we're on this same mission together, and it's really linked us up ever since. He has a very tactical perspective of what happened in on the objective on Reindeer. And I have more of a macro view with the pre-mission planning and the air piece. So I'll start and just share my recollections on the operation. And at this time, I'm going to bring up the map of the overview of the operation. As you're looking at that, a couple of points about it. One, it's over 175 miles away. This is early on, and in June, we just got into Baghdad, I think in May. And so a lot of the bridges were blown out and things like that on all the main roads there. So this mission came up on our radar on June 10th. I was getting ready to fly. We were doing missions every night, as Matt can attest to. And I was getting ready to take off to go out on an assault somewhere. And our boss asked me to come in and look at this feed from an airborne intelligence platform that was overhead this target. And I remember looking at it, and we saw a bunch of these bad guys doing rifle PT and marching around, and there was a Sealand type container, or what we would call in the military a Connex, in the wadi that it looked like they were living in. And they said, hey, this could be a target for us tomorrow. So I got my flight leads together, and we got with the Ranger leadership from Matt's company. And we did a quick straw man, basically. Okay, if we had to do this thing, this is how we would do it. But then we had to take off and go fly our missions. And as we walked out the door, we were told, hey, we're not the primary option. The 101st is going to get this mission. and we're just a backup. And so that was where we left it. And I flew all night. And the next day, on the 11th of June, 2003, one of the headquarters guys from the Joint Ops Center came and woke me up at around 10 in the morning. We think we had went down around 6 or 7 and said, hey, we're going to execute. You need to go see the CG. We're going to execute this mission. So, you know, the first thing I thought of was, oh, crap, I better, better start thinking about this. I wasn't even thinking about it. I was disappointed that we weren't going to get to do it. But now all of a sudden we were the choice. The 5th Corps commander at the time, General McKiernan, they had gotten indications those bad guys were all going to head out and attack coalition bases in the next 24 hours. And that's how we got elevated up to be in the primary option there. So we started planning so it was what we call, in the special ops community, it was what we call a half gaff operation. So the half, HAF, stands for helicopter assault force, and gaff stands for ground assault force. So basically the ground assault force was going to go in on the west side of this wadi, a valley is not a good word, but basically a giant ditch or something, eroded area. And we were going to land in helicopters on the east side, sandwich them in, and then clear the objective. So the ground assault force, which was the company commander, was on that, if I remember right. They took off at around 3:30 in the afternoon local time, because it was a 175-mile drive. And they left before we ever even did the briefing for the operation. I embedded, as the air commander, we embedded some rearm, refuel guys in that Ranger convoy that went up to Rawa, because we had made a decision that we were going to have a refuel rearm point right outside of the objective area so we wouldn't have a delay, because we thought this was going to be a significant fight. You see, as the crow flies, it's 175 miles from Baghdad International Airport up to Rawa. You also see off to the left Al Asad Air Base. And Al Asad is where, when we took off, we flew, the helicopter flew to Al Asad, refueled at Al Asad, and then from there we went to the objective area. So the GAF departed at 3:30. We did the air mission brief with the key leaders. And I know, Matt, you weren't sure if you were in there or not, but we did it on the hangar floor and we had all the key leaders. So I suspect you were in there. And we did the final brief, and then everybody, you know, the aviators went to prepare the aircraft and the Rangers went to prepare their own personal kit and their weapons for that, the nights off. We took off, the helicopter assault force took off, and we landed at Al Asad Air Base at about 8:30 at night for refuel before we went on to the objective. And as we got gas, and we, you know, it was a flight of two 47s and then four Blackhawks, four MH-60Ks at the time. One of the Blackhawks, an engine starter failed on one of the engines, and that aircraft was non-operational. So we quickly executed what we call a bump plan and reshuffled the Rangers all that we could to the other aircraft and took off without that aircraft. We left 2 minutes late, but ended up making the time up en route. It was about an hour flight or so from Al Asad up to Rawa. So at this point, before we get to the infiltration phase, I'm going to talk a little bit about the pre-assault fires and that occurred. And at H minus 20 minutes, a flight of six F-16s flew down that valley, that wadi that we were hitting in Objective Reindeer, and dropped multiple 2,000-pound JDAM bombs in that valley. I was initially on pre-planned targets. One of them was that Sealand container. And I think there was 40 guys in that thing, and they got a direct hit on that. I was really worried initially, and I expressed my concerns to my boss, the commanding general, about the dust those bombs were gonna create for us and may obscure our HLZs going in there. And they said, don't worry about it. You know, don't worry about the dust. But there was a tremendous amount of dust. But luckily, the winds were such that the dust had blown over that town of Rawa. And then, so the F-16s came in at H hour minus 20 minutes. at H minus 15 minutes to H minus 5 minutes. The AC-130 was doing preparatory fires in that on the targets, pre-planned targets in that wadi. And then from H minus 5 minutes to H plus 4 hours or so, two teams of two, a total of four AH-6 attack helicopters were servicing calls for fire and some other targets in the objective area, which was fairly significant. It took some multiple, all of those aircraft were damaged. One took a direct hit from a RPG in the nose, which did not explode, which we were fortunate. So now I'm bringing you up to H hour. And at H hour, we had the 60s land first, right on H hour. And then 2 minutes after that were the two 47s. I was in the lead 47 along with you, Matt. And we had a 60 in trail, and we landed in the HLZ, and you guys got out. At that point, the 60s departed, went back to Al-Asad for gas, and the 247s went into a holding pattern about 2 minutes away while you guys cleared the objective. We took what I would categorize as fairly intense enemy fire on the infiltration as we inserted the Ranger assault force, but it was largely ineffective just because the wadi was blocking their ability to suppress their guns low enough to get us. So basically they were shooting over the top of us and we flew underneath it. And then we dropped off and you know, for a while there, our mission was done. And at this point, Matt, I was gonna hand it off to you. Or before I do, let me back up. Simultaneously, while we were infiltrating the Rangers on the east side of the objective, the ground assault force had driven up and established blocking positions on the west side and a mortar position to do calls for fire in support of the Rangers. And you'll see those slides as I go through this that have been up on the screen there. So with that, Matt, I'm going to pass it off to you. And if you would... share with us basically from the time you got out of the aircraft and through your injury and what and how the mission went from your perspective.
Yeah, well, honestly, it was, let me start with flying with you guys was always a pleasure. It was the times when I'm flying, it was always, I was always at ease knowing we were in your guys' hands. You might even doze a little bit on the birds as you're flying somewhere because we were in your guys' very capable hands. Yeah, we landed at the FARP. I think we that's what they told us. Is that where the JMAL bird was? Was that right. The FARP?
Yep. Yeah, there was, yeah.
I don't think it was there yet. I don't actually recall, but I don't recall it there. And sitting there while you guys refueled, and then I think that's the time you're talking about the preparatory fires were going on as we were in the FARP. And you know, at that point, I mean, that's, you're like, okay, great. But, you know, whether it's happening or not is you're thinking about your piece of the pie. So, you know, I knew it was going down. We get back on the birds and, not that you really start ramping up for game time. Cause the whole time you're going, just about every mission you go on, whether it was a dry hole or not, you're thinking this is the one, all right, you know, I gotta be on my A game. This day was no different. And what made it different is when we landed, and I'll get to that in a second. But yeah, we're flying through. You know, you start getting the time hacks about how close you are to the objective, you know, all your minute hacks and whatnot. And the birds are all blacked out. I tell you what, there's nothing cooler than being in a blacked out bird with night vision, you know, with all your boys just ready to go. There are great feelings in the world other than this, but that is definitely in the top couple. Yeah, it's a pretty amazing feeling. So we're getting our time hacks. Birds are coming into the objective and you get your final time hack and you get up on a knee. You've got your rifle across your knee. You've got one hand on the gate of your snap link. And when that bird starts flaring and it starts shaking, there again, there's another really rad feeling is when that bird, you feel it coming in, it's slowing down and it starts shaking and you're like, oh man, here we go again. That was always a pretty cool feeling. So bird touches down, ramp drops, and the birds were facing towards the objective. So we're facing away off the ramp. Ramp drops, birds still kind of rolling a little bit. Ramp drops, we peel off to the right, so the left side of the bird. We peeled off, and it's such a flat area. We immediately just got online and started spreading out towards the objective. And like I said, right when we landed, that's when things really changed, because there was tracers everywhere. And that's when you're like, yeah, oh boy, this is hot. This is a hot objective. Here we go. And I think, like you had said, we were a couple, 2 minutes behind. So our intermediate support by fire had already set in. And I saw nothing but tracers on that side. So our 240s were rocking and rolling all over the place. There was just a lot of hate going towards the Wadi at that point. So we're pushing up online, and it's loud. I always flew with the my earplugs in, but I think right as we get to the objective, I'd either pop them in my pocket, but I think I just popped them out that day. And as we're running up, you know, the sound of that level of combat was huge. I mean, it was so damn loud. And we keep pushing up, and I forget the distance, but all of a sudden I hear a rocket come from down in the wadi going up. And I'm guessing that's what they were doing at that point, was shooting at your little birds. And but it was so loud that you know, it made us jump down. We're like, oh my God, that was close, you know. And you think that the first thing you hear that rocket, you're thinking it's coming at me. Well, no, it wasn't, because it's like you said, they were down in that defilade, and you know, they were shooting at the little birds going overhead. Still, it made you pucker and jump down. So realizing that we weren't taking rounds, we get back up online, start pushing off. We're creeping closer. I'm guessing we're within 50 meters of the edge of the wadi there. And another RPG goes up, and that makes you duck, but you realize it's not coming at you. We push up, and now we're probably within 5 to 10 meters of the edge of the wadi. And I still can't see down below me. That was a pretty steep wall, as I recall. And there was vehicles burning down, like we discussed earlier, down to the west. Yeah, down to my west in one of the draws there. And the whole north side of the wadi was lit up like daylight. Those vehicles were burning like nothing else. And I remember thinking, I'm like, okay, great. Now they can see us a little bit better. This kind of sucks. And then as I'm sitting there, I'm starting to scan a little bit in front of me, and I see fighting positions dug into the top of the wadi. And there was nothing in there at that point, whether air assets cleaned those out or they just weren't manned. I don't know. My intermediate support by fire was off to my left. And all of a sudden I see their lasers were on, and you can see the recoil of their lasers just bouncing all over the place, you know, engaging targets down below me right where I can't see. And I thought at that point, I was like, well, yeah, I want to get involved too. But then I also thought, yeah, but two RPGs just came from down there. So I'm not like going to stick my head out and go, what's going on down there? I don't want to catch one of those in the face. So they were rocking and rolling. And then at that point we got word to move down into the wadi, or to that draw into the wadi. And that portion was the main effort. And we were the point for the main effort going in. Second squad was. So we get into the wadi, I'm sorry, the draw. And then there's that vehicle right there in front of me burning. And I'm like, I'm watching this thing. I mean, not just like this, but you know, you're sitting there watching it, you know, scanning, and you're waiting for targets to start coming in front of you, because at that point the draw was pretty narrow as well. So I was waiting for targets to present themselves, you know, coming laterally in front of me. They didn't, because they were dug in like ticks, I think, at that point, or dead. But there's that vehicle burning, and it's bright. It's as bright as a street out there, you know, an American street with all the street lights on. It was almost broad daylight. And I was like, man, this is not good. And I thought about, well, maybe I can run up and kick dirt on it or something. And, you know, knowing how vehicles burn, you need an entire fire truck to put those things out. So I was like, okay, we're just going to have to deal with this. And then my squad leader, you know, one of my good buddies, I can hear him behind me, and he, well-trained dude, just top-notch ranger. He went to go do bigger and better things, outside rangers eventually, but just a top-notch dude. And he understood, and we, as we all did, violence of action. We're keeping these guys on their heels up against the ropes. We need to keep our violence of action up to maintain fire superiority and win in this fight. The second you let them catch a breather is a second longer that they have to establish themselves and, you know, maybe return some hate back in your direction. So we definitely wanted to keep going. And I remember he was on his radio, like, we need to move now. We're ready. We're in position. We need to go. We need to go. We need to go. And, you know, again, at your level, you know that, hey, there's a lot of moving pieces. We can't just let you guys go before we do shift fires, or, you know, air assets are out of the way, or air assets know you're moving. So hold your horses just a sec. I'm sure he's being told. But he definitely let the let them know the immediacy of, hey, we need to go, and we want to get in this fight. So as I'm sitting there raring to go, and I'm in the right at the edge of the draw going into the wadi, probably – I don't know, 20, 25 meters from that burning truck. You know, he finally tells me, he's like, waters move. So, you know, I know when my piece of the pie was button hooking to the left into the wadi. I pick up and, you know, you bust around that corner and you're ready. I mean, there's, you don't know what's coming. You're going around a blind corner. There's no, like, just kind of peek in. It was, hey, we need to go. We need to get in this fight. So, it was a little nerve-wracking going around the corner, but that's what you do. And I got my night vision down. I had 14s. Mm. So I had – that was the nice thing about the 14s in that aspect was with all that light, you know, and it's the same thing with CQB is you could have your night vision down and use your naked eye, you know, and operate both. So if one walked into a bright room or a fire like that, you can still pop up and use your red dot sight and engage if need be. So, you know, some people don't like them. I was always a fan of just the 14s. So bust around the corner and I start scanning and there's nothing in front of me. I've got my my laser going with a spotlight on it and I'm scanning and there's nothing in front of me. Gunfire and explosions are still going off all over. You know, I know the AH-6s are up there somewhere because you can hear them, those chainsaws going off and, you know, the rockets going here and there. And that was always a comforting feeling. So as I'm scanning, I'm walking and I'm stumbling, and I didn't know it at the time, but that's where you just spoken about the fast movers came in and dropped their ordnance in that area. And I'm thinking I'm just walking on churned up dirt and whatnot, which I probably was, but come to find out later from some of my buddies, I was actually walking over pieces of enemy fighters, you know. But due to my night vision being whited out from the fires, you know, or limited, I should say, I couldn't see that well. And plus, I'm not worried exactly what's exactly right here in front of me. I'm more worried about what's out here. So I'm scanning, and now I've got the wadi wall on my left. And I'm just scanning in front of me, and I look to my left, and in the wadi wall, I see a dugout of some sort. And I'm looking at it. Checking it out, and you know, there's nothing going on. And as you well know, with night vision and infrared and all that jazz, eyeballs glint really well in your night vision, you know, so you can see if like animals or people are looking at you because you can see that glint. And I'm looking, I'm like, okay, I don't see anybody looking at me, I don't see any glint, you know, I don't see any weapon, there's nothing there. And you know, I start coming to my front. And actually, I should back up. Right before that, as we're, you know, I'm stumbling along across dirt and bodies and whatnot, from behind me, I hear two quick gunshots. And, you know, you're already so amped up, and you hear two gunshots from behind you, and A, you don't have time to think, well, this is it. Your training kicks in, and I was just on the ground before I knew it. You know, you're scared. You're thinking you're getting shot at. Well, what it was my squad leader, we're walking over these dudes and all this dirt and whatnot and equipment, and he stepped on something, and it was a guy's arm, and the guy jerked his arm. So he did the double tap. You know, you're supposed to be double tapping as we're going across the objective. He steps on this guy's arm. He jerks his arm. He's like, oh, my God, and right at his feet, double taps this guy. And that's what I heard, you know, and I'm thinking that I'm about to buy the farm. And I realized that it was him shooting, because then he starts yelling. He goes, well, I won't say exactly what he said, but he's, it was something along the lines of, the G-rated version would be, hey, you guys better start double tapping these bodies as we come across them. And my G-rated response was, well, I would if I could see anything, because my eye pro was fogging up, because I'm breathing heavy. You know, I've got that body armor on, my body heat's just coming up into my face, and my Wiley X's were fogging up. So I'd actually stuck them in my K-pod at that point, in the band of my K-pod. So we had a quick back and forth about, you know, actions on what we should be doing on the objective there. And I knew we should be, but honestly, I was more concerned about what I couldn't see and what was in front of me than what was right below me. But ultimately he was right too. So then that's when I come to the dugout. I see the dugout, and then I'm scanning from my left. When I realize there's nothing in there, I start scanning to my front. And right when I get to my front, you know, mind you, I've got the fire behind me. I look up in front of me, and then I see circular glass glinting. And I had enough time to go, oh crap, G-rated version. I had enough time to go, oh crap. And I get my rifle up. And what I was looking at was the scope on an RPG. And the firelight, you know, it had caught the glass had caught the firelight behind me, it had given away his position. But because, you know, the fire was limiting my night vision, I can only see probably 50 meters, pretty solid. And he was right at that cusp. I'm thinking he was probably about the 30 meter range. And, you know, with the firelight behind me, I was backlit. My whole team, my whole squad was backlit all day long. And he was just sitting there waiting. And so he did. And I see the glass, and I have enough time to get my rifle up. And I don't remember this, but my squad said I got one round off. And I might have even yelled contact, or I don't remember that. I think they're just trying to pad my ego, making me think I did my job. But the next thing I remember is I see the glass. I have enough time to switch from safe to semi, and I'm coming up. And then I remember thousands of Orton sparks going from my right to my left, up past my head. And then I had that feeling of my arms coming up. And what had happened was he was in a fighting position, probably about to his waist level right here. And he fired the rocket and went right along the ground, probably, you know, maybe a foot off the ground. And it hit my leg and blew up underneath me, or with what I think was right underneath me. So it blows me up, and I've got that feeling of I'm suddenly very much lighter. And then thousands of orange sparks going past my head. I come crashing back down to earth, and I must have started going ass over tea kettle, because even through my helmet, my Mitch helmet, not my K-pot, my Mitch helmet, I scalped the back of my head clean. Like the hair and scalp was all gone, because I came back down with such force that even through my my Mitch, that it just sheared the back of my head clean. Wow. And that's when, you know, things get kind of fuzzy for me. But through all my buddy talks and interviews and whatnot, and what I do remember, they said, I don't remember this, and I want the satisfaction of knowing I shot back, you know. But they said I sat back up, put my rifle on my shoulder and engaged. And then my weapon went cold. Well, what happened was, is I had my weapon here as the guy engaged me, and thank God, because what happened was when it exploded, all the shrapnel came up into my gun and saved my beautiful face.
absolutely beautiful face. I'm so glad. Right,
unfortunately, I won't be a hand model, you know, I'm missing some other digits and whatnot, but, so I fired all my rounds, what I thought was my rounds, but what actually happened is my gun broke. It fired 29 rounds. You know, those M4s were pretty, well, at least mine was pretty stout. You know, it took a beating and kept on firing. And then that's when they said I started to struggle, because I was doing a magazine change, but, because of shrapnel wounds here, cause I had my gun in front of my face and my hand all messed up, my elbow messed up, my hands were just completely jacked up. They said I was trying to do a magazine change, but nothing was working. And that's when I was finally laid back. And I think that's when I came to, because I remember being on my back, and I think the first thing was I had my eyes closed, or it was so dark at that point looking up at the sky because I was on my back, that I just felt the most intense pain in both my legs. And you know something's wrong. You know you've been hit. You know you're not dead because you're still thinking. You know you're still breathing. And I just remember thinking, all right, I was like, okay, you've been hurt really bad. What did I say to myself? I was like, your legs are hurt bad, but they hurt because they're still there. I was trying to convince myself that I wasn't hurt that bad. And then I think I was able to wiggle my right leg, and I was like, okay, that's good. That one's, you know, okay. And then I lifted my head up, and in the firelight, I could see my left leg was up, and it was kind of like crooked like that because it was suddenly much lighter. And I could see the shredded pant leg just hanging in the firelight. And I thought, I put my head back and I thought, son of a, and probably to my dying day, I'll hear about this. But I said something along the lines of, that son of a bitch shot my shifting leg off. And I was big into riding dirt bikes. And I should probably ask, probably not okay to cuss on this too much, huh?
Yeah, we'll keep it to the PG level, I think. I think you're okay now.
Okay. Well, I'm just adding to the realism then, because that's exactly what I said on that one. I thought, oh, he shot my shifting leg off. And, you know, my wife, when she heard the story, was like, oh, so your first thought wasn't about your family. It was about your dirt bike and riding. And I'm like, well, no, it was simultaneous. You know, there's a lot going on there. I thought about you guys too. No, but that's, you know, a good Ranger wife is always kind of poking at you. You know, she knows.
Keeping it real.
Right. So I'm laying there, and now I know I'm jacked up. And I heard someone scream for the medic, and we actually got our medic, Doc Gonzalez, who I still talk to this day. We actually got him while we were in theater. He came to us. And right away, he was one of the most squared away guys I'd ever met in my life. You know, just totally gelled with the platoon immediately. Just a great, great guy. And I heard the cry for medic. And I remember looking over to my right, and I'm on my back. And in the firelight, I see Doc as nothing, you know, he's sprinting. He's nothing but Usain Bolt straight up to me. And he slides in. And granted, at this time, there's still rounds popping off. I mean, fire overhead going on, grenades are going off. And here's Doc running up, you know, and you see he's got his med bags ready to go. He slides in next to me. And we had those ratchet tourniquets at that point. He gets that ratchet tourniquet on, stops me from watering the desert with all my blood. And then he starts in on, you know, packaging me and treating me, you know, doing all the proper checks, making sure I don't have any exit wounds or anything, you know, stopping the major bleeding, making sure I don't have any airway problems, you know, any wounds up on my top end. And he does his good medic stuff, like, hey, keep talking to me. And, you know, I'm in so much pain at that point. I'm like, I don't want to talk to you. I'm hurting. Leave me alone. And he goes, all right, I want you to sing or say your ABCs to me. I'm like, Doc, and I'm not, you know, this nice. I was like, Doc, no, I'm not singing my ABCs to you right now. He goes, okay, then I want you to tell me about your family. And that kind of, you know, brought me around. It's like, okay. And I started talking about Lindsay and Owen at that point. Then somebody yells grenade. And at this, still to this day, I don't know if it was a grenade going out and someone was all charged up and they didn't yell frag out versus grenade. But Doc hears grenade and thinking one is coming in. And he lays over the top of me. And that, for the longest time, I really struggled with talking about, because there was nothing wrong with Doc. And I was almost, I don't want to say I was almost dead, but, you know, we're maybe standing on the doorstep. I don't want to say we were knocking on the door, but.
He wasn't singing, but she was on stage for sure.
Yeah, right. Yeah, she was on deck. So it was hard for me to talk about how Doc would give his life for what was left of mine. And that was, you know, you hear all the stuff about greater love, you know, hath no man than this, and, you know, the Ranger Creed and all the other things we're taught as young Rangers and military folk. But when it's put into action and you're part of that, that was something. that Doc was going to sacrifice either all of him or part of him to save what was left of me. That was, I don't want to say it was pretty cool, but it was hard to fathom. You know, it's hard to know that people do that for you. And honestly, I'm forever grateful. What an amazing act, what an amazing person. So he does that. It ends up either being a dud, or they were also throwing frags into the grass, because when I shot back, they said I shot back. There was actually two guys in that fighting position. And when I shot back, the one guy, the gunner, went back down and loaded another round. And his buddy was like, nope, catch you later. And he popped out and jumped into the wadi, into the cattails or the reeds, whatever it was. And then intermediate support by fire, and my boys were chasing him with frags and rounds and whatnot, because I don't think he was the only one that went in there. And then when the gunner loaded the round, he came back up. The intermediate support by fire just turned him into a pile of goo, let him have it. So they packaged me up in the Skedco. And at that point, our SOP was, you know, you put your body armor, all your sensitive items go with you. My body armor was on top of me. My helmet was on top of me. And I was struggling to breathe, and that was not a good feeling. And I remember thinking that I'll chance it and take another round. I want to get oxygen. I'm struggling. This sucks. So I kept throwing my helmet as they're dragging me past people, that kept throwing my helmet at somebody, and they put it back on me. I was like, I don't want it. And I'd throw it back at whoever was there. And I was like, it's kind of not my problem right now. I'm focusing on surviving. You can take my helmet for me. So they dragged me up the hill, and granted, I knew I was a heavy burden on them. They're dragging me up the hill, and sorry, my dog is going nuts. Can you guys hear that?
It's all right.
So they're dragging me up the hill, and I can hear them sucking wind. You know, they're all charged up as well. Their adrenaline's going. They're struggling to breathe, just carrying my heavy butt up the hill in the Skedco, or dragging me up it. And I start rolling over in the Skedco because the ground is all uneven, and I was able to work my hand out and prop myself up so I wouldn't roll onto my face, and they dragged me on my face, which I wouldn't have been too appreciative of. But I got my hand out and braced myself, and then I got mad at them. And then I realized, I was like, dude, they're helping you. Hold on a minute. And then when I brought my hand back in, that's when I noticed that my thumb was hanging just by a flap. And I think that's actually when it tore off, is when I placed my hand down on the ground. And then I started in on them. I'm like, hey boys, I love you. Thank you for carrying me up this hill. I'm sorry you have to carry me up this hill. And then they drug me into the casualty collection point. And hold on, I got to put this on pause for a second. That's going to drive me nuts. My dog's going bonkers.
Hopefully you didn't kill the dog.
She's right here.
So you can pick it back up with, you know, you're in the HLZ.
Yeah. So they dragged me into the HLZ, and, you know, the pain the entire time was just, it was awful. I mean, you wouldn't wish that on anybody. Pete Rothke was my first sergeant at the time, and he was always, I don't want to say he was high strung, but he was always very intense, whether it was in training or in combat. You know, the nice thing about it was, I remember feeling comfort because he comes up to me and it was the same level of intensity, and not like he was overboard. You know, he always did his job very well, and it was very comforting knowing that I'm in a combat situation, I'm wounded, and he's acting the same exact way as he does in training. There was no difference, and that was rad. Having somebody in charge of you like that was a great comforting feeling, you know, when you're that wounded. And he comes up to me, and he called me Agua, you know, last name Waters, so his nickname for me was Agua. And he comes up to me, and he just starts filling out my casualty feeder cards. And as he's hunched over me, filling out the cards, rounds start snapping over our head. And the RTO comes running up, Antes comes running up, and he goes, First Sergeant, we're getting shot at. And he didn't even miss a beat. He's like, we'll take care of it in a minute. And he keeps just writing down, you know, all the information on the card. It's like, I think I might have even giggled because that was pretty funny. And then my senior medic was there, Gillespie, and I'm in a ton of pain. And I remember asking, I was like, dude, can I get painkillers? Can you do something? And I want to say the answer was no at that point, just because they don't know how wounded you are. I don't, you know, at that point, most of my finer training, like medical stuff, had gone out of my head because I'm just worried about surviving. And I thought I got a shot of morphine somewhere, and it is not like the movies where you get hit with morphine and the guy's like, oh yeah, I got hit with it. And I'm like, okay, when's it kicking in? I'm ready. I'm ready to not feel this anymore. So, yeah, the first sergeant went and his entourage went and took care of that problem that they were having with the rounds being shot at them. And I think actually the radio got shot off the RTO's back. I think he caught a round like on the buckle of his ruck, and it flew, you know, his ruck flew off his back, but then they dispatched their problem and then went about their business. And then the next thing I remember is probably one of the most glorious sounds in the world was that heavy rotor beat of the 47 coming in. And I can't remember if they came in guns a-blazing or not. I think they did. And that's just, whether you're wounded or not, that's always impressive, you know, and it's such a good feeling knowing that they're coming in to get you, you know? So they came in, they loaded me on the HL or on the bird from the casualty collection point, and then off I went, and I'd lost quite a bit of blood. My mouth was dry, like it's never been dry. I've never been that thirsty in my life. And I knew you guys always had like fridges and freezers, and you always had the nicest iced bottled water. And I'm like, I would like a drink of that water right now. And I'm calling out to the crew member, and he can't hear me over the rotor blades. And, you know, in my weak state, I'm probably not yelling that loud anyway. And I keep seeing his feet walk by. And I think I was on the left side of the bird, and I worked my other hand out and I grabbed his leg as he went by, and he leans down and he's like, yeah, what's up? And I was like, can I just get some water? He's like, yeah, sure. And he got one of those bottled waters that you guys had, and it was the coldest, most delicious water I've ever had in my life. Gave me a couple sips, and then we landed at the FARP, and they unasked me from the bird. And they put me on a quad, and that's when I thought I was going to buy it, because they put me on the back of the quad, and that guy raced off towards the JMAL bird at, you know, like fifth gear, wide open, it felt like. And I thought, oh my God, I'm gonna die out here in a Skidco. And though they got me on the JMAL bird, and that's when I got the chance to, you know, I'm in some sort of light. It wasn't this bright, but some sort of light, and I can see I'm covered in blood. You know, I'm all jacked up. I can see my shredded pant leg. And, that's when I told them some things. I was like, hey, you know, I don't think I'm doing so hot. And they were like, no, no, you're fine. You know, they were great medics, you know, good doctors taking care of you. And then they put me out, and, I woke up in Kuwait. Well, what you could maybe call waking up in Kuwait. I was in some sort of opioid stupor. And all I remember is the top of the roof of the tents going by as they wheeled me from place to place. I'm sure I had a couple surgeries there and some life-saving stuff go on there, but I don't remember it. And then they also, somebody grabbed my head one time and said, hey, you're going to call home. Don't tell them where you were. Don't tell them anything, you know, Ranger, this, that, and the other, you know, all the OPSEC stuff. And it's not like I knew much anyway. And I was pretty high at that point. And they plugged the phone up to my head. And that's when I got to talk to Lindsay, and that was tough. That was hard talking to her. I really, really broke down. And, you know, being on that much drugs, things don't make a lot of sense. And all I remember saying as I kept apologizing to her over and over and over, you know, thinking, I think somewhere in my head, I thought that I messed her life up, you know? So that's the gist. Because from there they put me on a 141, I think, to launch tool, and then the unit actually flew Lindsay out there got an emergency passport and flew her out to Germany to link up with me.
Well, you filled in a lot of what obviously I didn't know. I remember when you got hit, the radio call came in and said, we have an eagle down, and we moved, like I told you before we started, we kept moving the aircraft closer and closer. So we were in a position as soon as they were ready for us to get in there and get you to the hospital. And then from there, obviously the mission continued for us, and we police it up. There was 70 to 100 enemy killed in action on that one. Thousands of rocket propelled grenades, surface air missiles. To this day, I haven't seen that many enemy weapons off of any objective as we got off of that one. And I will tell you, as we wrap this up, Matt, that, I am convinced this day, first of all, it was the most significant mission I've flown, and I've been on a few. And it's the most significant for a couple of reasons. One, obviously, the intensity of the combat was significant. But I just had this feeling that we had saved a bunch of lives, because it came out later that they were going to break up, I think, in three-man teams and do suicide attacks on coalition bases across Iraq. And we caught them right before they did that, I think, which is one of the reasons why, we got that mission. And you ended up on that we both ended up on that objective that night. So yeah, I really appreciate you sharing your story with us. And to me, what you've done with your life after, and you're continuing to serve as a police officer, and especially in this day and age, I know it's, that is truly selfless service. But you continued to row the boat. You've been a great father to Owen and Zoe. And I met Lindsay last time I was in Washington with you. And then I saw you at the SHOT Show here last year, or earlier this year. But listen, thanks for sharing that, Matt. I value your friendship. I'm honored to have served with you. And
likewise.
I just really appreciate it. So thank you, sir.
My pleasure.